you get down to where the guy that's spending the most money can get elected. Well, hell, what you do is just set up a CPA in every state to certify. Y'all come out, you two boys come in here now, turn in all your money. Mr. Jones, you got the most. You're the governor.
Will they hurt my mommy? Will they hurt my mommy? Will they hurt her?
96% of the food price increases that we've had in the last 20 years have gone not to farmers at all, but to corporate middlemen, the people that take the food from the farm and sell it to consumers. That's primarily the processors, the grain shippers, the cotton trade, and the supermarkets in the country are who you're dealing with there.
This is the famous Abraham Zapruder film of the Kennedy assassination. As the president's limousine emerges from behind the sign, it's obvious he has been struck by a bullet. He slumps forward, and then the fatal headshot.
We look back to see what programs were on Alternative Views from 1978 through 1979. Right now, on Alternative Views. It's November 1987. Alternative Views is starting its 10th year. So why don't we look back and see what Alternative Views was like in its first year, from October of 1978 through October 1979. As you will see, the equipment certainly left something to be desired, sometimes even our skills. But the intent then is the same as now, to provide you with alternative information.
The Supreme Court has said that the mass media should be an uninhibited marketplace where all ideas can contend. Well, that was a few years ago. You might not be able to tell that by some of the recent court decisions. But that is what we try to do on Alternative Views. We take information from the left, from the right, from the business press, particularly emphasizing those stories and ideas and people which either are not allowed to be on the establishment media or things that are distorted and censored in the media. So I'd like to show you just some examples of what we've been doing.
My father's own father, he waded that river. They took all the money he made in his life. My brothers and sisters came working the fruit trees. They rode the big trucks till they laid down and died.
Mojados are otherwise in this country known as by the derogatory term wetbacks. Tonight on Alternative Views, we're going to study the plight and courage of these people who continue to come in search of a better life from Mexico. Undaunted by the hostility of our own government, harassment by the Immigration and Naturalization Service, employer exploitation, language barriers, hostility by our own community, they continue to come in a flood. Tonight we're going to have two people.
Alternative Views is a variable program with a flexible format. There can be several guests discussing one subject or several subjects, or there can be one guest. There can also be many reports providing in-depth information on special subjects. And there's almost always a news section emphasizing information and analysis not covered by the mass media. For instance, the big steelworker strike at Newport News, Virginia.
Arrests by local and state police. Suddenly, between 100 and 300, depending on what accounts you have, police troopers apparently went berserk. They went roving and raging up and down a 15-block area of the city, chasing strikers and eventually beating anybody who got in their way, women, even scabs who happened to be there. Chasing people down corridors, going into little shops, coffee houses, dragging people out, beating them, and eventually winding up at the union headquarters, going in there and beating up people, dragging them outside and trying to storm the whole headquarters. Well, Al, I think you have the biggest stories here today.
Okay, Frank. It was reported on CBS News not too long ago that personal income rose from 1% in March. End of story. What they fail to tell you, of course, is that the top 20% of the income class, people making over $26,000 a year, get almost half of any gain in personal income. The top 40%, which includes people making roughly over $20,000 a year, get almost 70% of any gain in personal income. And by the time you get down to what most of us are making, or, you know, around $14,000, $13,000 a year.
You make that much?
Well,
wow.
Most of the average Americans, the average here is what we're talking about, Frank.
Okay.
It's up to 83% of the personal income gains. And then about a week later, they get into the inflation picture. And the reason I'm mentioning this is that people are having a difficult time associating how this gain in income can be completely wiped out by inflation. But last March, this March, actually 1979, the rate of inflation hit 1% for the month. For the year, going back to March 78, that's a gain of 10%. And if it keeps up at the same rate for the rest of this year, it'll be a gain of 13%. What they're not telling you is that inflation in the basic necessities, such as gasoline, was up almost 4% for the month. Not for the year, for the month. Food was up 2.7% for the month. Clothing was up 1.6% for the month. Housing was up 1% for the month. Now let's translate that into bucks. Willard Mueller has estimated that any 1% gain in just the food sector alone of the economy can yield $1.5 billion to the top concentrated food processors, Frank. Mm-hmm. So I'll turn it back to you.
I guess that means I got to go out and get a job, doesn't it?
Really?
On the news section of our program, we encourage group participation so that people can provide input from varying backgrounds, not only from the regular participants, but also from the guests.
And what you see now with austerity is a pattern of austerity being enforced on these countries. Really, the United States is the latecomer in this pattern. It happened, first of all the way going back into the early 1970s, when even with the revolutionary upheaval in Portugal in 1974, the new government was faced with the fact that in order to attract private capital, it had to make concessions. And the blackmail that the multinationals and the international creditors have forced on it has been to reverse the land reform began and to reverse some of the nationalization of industry that went on in Portugal.
And it's not only the capitalist the countries and the third world countries, it's also the socialist countries. There's an article in the Wall Street Journal saying that banks are, and the International Monetary Fund, are trying to put the squeeze on Poland to do the same thing. Remember, they did this in Peru several years ago. In order for Peru to get the credits, they had to raise the price of bread and food. There were riots. So they didn't do it. They tried again to do it. There were more riots.
This is
a real problem.
This is very curious, Frank, because it hasn't been reported at all in the Western press, but there's a tremendous left opposition movement in Poland of workers who have been demonstrating and going on strike and doing things that are unprecedented in socialist countries in terms of organizing a resistance to government austerity programs.
Following the news, we have other topics and also guests. Can be one guest or maybe several, and on one topic or maybe different ones. Perhaps the most delightful guest was humorist John Henry Falk, who spoke on many subjects, particularly the McCarthy period, of which he was a blacklist victim.
It turned loose on our society some of the most degenerate elements of the society, peddlers of fear, manipulators of fear, and we have paid a terrible, terrible price for it. Men who practice secrecy in government, men who used appeal to the lowest common denominator in the American character, namely fear and racism.
Richard Nixon's always done that.
And Richard Nixon is the direct result of this. We paid a terrible penalty for it. The real penalty we paid was Vietnam. Watergate. We've reaped a terrible harvest for having turned our back on these guarantees and allowed fear and manipulated villainy to to stampede us away from those basic institutions of justice that the American people have erected in their wisdom over the past two centuries.
Later, John Henry started talking about the easiest, most practical way to hold elections in Texas, where the big bucks are so important.
Intelligent dialogue. And you get down to where the guy that's spending the most money can get elected. Well, hell, what you do is just set up a CPA in every state to certify. Y'all come out. You two boys come in here now. Turn in all your money. Mr. Jones, you got the most. You're the governor. And he saved the taxpayers a lot of money on an election. You wouldn't even have to have one. Since issues aren't the thing that's involved now, and money is.
A fellow liberal with John Henry Falk, Ralph Yarborough, former senator from Texas, is still a strong, ardent populist.
This is a end result of corporate control of a state government in the quality of life we're denied the people of Texas, in books, in health, we're way down in health, in education, in care of the young and the aged, and all the great humanitarian things that make, I think, for culture, make for progress of a people, make how we stand as a people. We stand around the 48th in these categories and 49th. This is a disgrace. The 13 million, I've made speeches like this over Texas for years. You don't see them in newspapers. They don't print this kind.
Our guest tonight is Edward Dmytryk, the Hollywood film director who directed such films in the 1950s as The Caine Mutiny, Soldier of Fortune with Clark Gable, The Left Hand of God with Humphrey Bogart, and two of my favorite films of the period, Rain Tree County and The Young Lions.
Like John Henry Falk, Edwin Dmytryk was also a victim of the McCarthy era.
Party at one time.
And perhaps you could go back a step and ask and tell us why you got in to the Communist Party and then why you got disillusioned.
I got into the Communist Party for the same reason that all intellectuals got into the Communist Party, because they were the only people that seemed to be doing anything for people. They were the only ones that were, for public housing, for decent welfare treatment, for all those things. They were against bigotry. Long before it was common, they were against anti-Semitism, any kind of bigotry of any kind. They stood for all the things that I think any progressive young person stands for, and they have a wonderful front. After I got in, I found out that this was a front, that this wasn't really what they were doing. They were doing it, but behind it was a big power grab. Mm-hmm. It's what they were afraid of in Hollywood. I know a great deal was made out of, was there communist propaganda in films, which is nonsense. How the hell can you put propaganda into films that the head of the studio, who was a first-class capitalist, will pass, won't notice, and yet the blue-collar worker in the street will? It's ridiculous.
Civil liberties are very important, and so as a result, we provide many stories, new stories, on civil liberties, and we've devoted two whole programs to the subject.
We've been talking here about DPS and the FBI, but we're not going to let our own local gendarmes off too easy.
How could we?
We have with us, as I mentioned at the top of the show, Jim Lutz from ACTV, who took some extraordinary pictures, filmed last year at the boat races on Town Lake. At this point, the policeman has grabbed my camera as I'm walking across the street. I'm wrestling with him, trying to regain use of my camera. It's turned off as I'm going across the street. At another point, the policeman also hit the camera from the side as I was viewing another scene. One thing that's really interesting was that in the Austin American Statesman and the local TV news media, the headlines were that the Chicanos had attacked police with a baseball bat and hammers, claw hammers. And however, no one was ever arrested for having used a baseball bat. However, one demonstrator had a baseball bat. It was taken from him early in the demonstration, and no one was ever arrested. No policeman was ever identified as being hit with a baseball bat. However, the headlines, as I mentioned, were that one policeman was hit, and it's as if the information that the public gets, they get the feeling that no wonder that the police, some of them maybe had overreacted, because after all, they were probably very excited after one of their fellow members had been hit with a baseball bat. However, the event never even took place.
What we've got is retreaded Dolph Briscoe Law and Order with Governor Bill Clement's signature across it. Last week, he...
Interchangeable parts. You notice this? It doesn't matter.
Introduced or put out a press statement saying, on many occasions I have stated I am for strong and effective law enforcement and recommend that the legislature adopt measures that will enable local, district, and state law enforcement officials to do a better job. And then he starts listing off bills which he will support as part of a law and order package. An examination of those bills shows that what you have coming back is essentially the same thing that a very conservative legislature rejected in 1977, insofar as the proposals are concerned. You've got electronic eavesdropping again. We scream drugs, crime, this sort of thing, and suddenly we hand to the police the tools by which they can go in and legally invade everyone's privacy. Forget about the Fourth Amendment. Forget about the Fifth Amendment. Just let them go in and listen to everyone.
You were supposed to get information within 10 days. In order to get my 100-page FBI file, it took 9 months. I was very, very involved in the women's movement here in the 60s when there were about 10 of us running around talking about women's liberation at the university, and everybody thought we were crazy. I also worked on The Rag, which was an underground newspaper, and I was involved in the anti-war movement here in the 60s. They have about 10 pages on all of my parents' friends in Brownsville, where I went to high school. They went to all sorts of professors, friends. I mean, it is really incredible the amount of information that they gathered and the waste of money. Nothing involves any breaking of law. I mean, it was sort of free speech that I went to a demonstration. They had things, they knew what meetings I went to, how many people were at the meetings. Then they have a little statement that Women's Liberation is an organization, if I can remember what they said, dedicated to the overthrow of male chauvinism and being dirty. The conclusion of my case was that I was classified as disloyal number 3.
Although the main emphasis on alternative views is the United States and its problems, we also have devoted a lot of time to subjects concerning international relations and other countries.
For every 400 whites in South Africa, there is one doctor. But for every 144,000 blacks, there's only one doctor. That's correct.
Moving on to the Cambodian border, this is in Anjan province, a place called Chau Dak, a place we visited that had recently had shelling by the Cambodians. And this is right on the border. Driving up along the border, we saw where there have been like at least 200,000 Vietnamese had to flee for their homes along the border, and houses were shelled and evacuated like this one here.
For our coverage of the Iranian situation, we've been very fortunate in having two Iranians to be on the program from time to time, one a professor from the University of Texas and the other a graduate student also from the University of Texas.
There's a tremendous potential for violence in rural Mexico. There has been relatively little change simply because people are unorganized and the Mexican government is extremely effective at first co-opting protest or secondly suppressing it. This is just one example where the town rebelled against the mayors, as are all political officials in Mexico, are appointed, and then the vote is carried out by the people who vote for the appointed candidate. And in this particular little town in the state of Tlaxcala, the people rebelled and drove out their mayor, and yet they were completely unorganized, they were unarmed.
There has been now, for at least since about 1970, the left-wing movement in Mexico has been growing. It was practically closeted before that. And it has developed an armed wing. There are terrorists of 16 different stripes in Mexico. And there are a few organizations which I regard as more literate, which organize peasants to seize land and arm them. On my first trip, I was scared to death. I expected I was going to run into some hot-headed students who were up there agitating the peasants and pulling all sorts of dangerous stunts. It turned out not to be true. The people in these pictures are peasants. One of these fellows has an old Remington. It's a Mexican Revolution vintage rifle. Here's another meeting of revolutionary peasants. Anytime you read Mexican newspapers, you will read of peasants seizing land and being lynched or shot anywhere in Mexico. It happens every week. It's public support is never sought. The peasants do this as their own affair. I've never heard of them seeking support.
Peace and disarmament are very important. We've had several representatives from the Mobilization of Survival on the program, and we've devoted whole programs to this subject.
The worst to be feared and the best to be expected can be simply stated. The worst is atomic war. The best would be this: a life of perpetual fear and tension, a burden of arms draining the wealth and labor of all peoples, a wasting of strength that defies the American system or the Soviet system or any system to achieve true abundance and happiness for the peoples of this earth. Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed.
It looks like a typical morning in front of Austin High School. Cars, students coming to school. Joggers out getting their morning exercise. But this morning would be a little bit different from the usual times. Concerned parents and students are getting together to have a demonstration to show their opposition to President Carter's decision to start draft registration. They gather, form a circle about an hour before classes start. Join the army, travel to exotic distant lands, meet exciting unusual people, and kill them.
Think they'll draft women?
Yes.
If they draft anybody?
I think that they should draft women too, but I don't think anyone should be drafted.
Yeah. What are you doing right now?
Protesting against the draft.
Against the draft?
I'm informing students that it affects them, but most of them don't realize
it. Yeah.
They then form a line and move toward the school. David Rockefeller, your oil is not worth the life of my child.
You expect any trouble from anybody?
No, this is a peaceful demonstration.
I mean, other people may not think so.
Well, we're hoping to reach the children, some of the children who don't have alternatives yet. We're hoping, I guess the kids are, actually this is their thing, we just came to support them, to reach them with the newsletter they've written, to show them alternatives, where they can go to get help, try to band together.
As they approach the school, they are met by a group of students, mostly looking on with curiosity, but a few with jeers.
This takes a bit of courage, doesn't it?
Yeah, I guess. It's kind of...
What do you suppose is going to happen when you get down here to the school?
I don't think we'll meet much opposition. Maybe vocal insults, but nothing physical. And a lot of support, too.
What do the kids there think down here at Austin?
They don't talk about it much. Most people are too apathetic about anything except their own lives to care about it.
Paralegal from another organization, and they said that we could be on the premises and in the school until they told us to leave, and then they had to give us a certain amount of time, and then after that we'd be violating the law. So we went through before and found out a lot of information about what would be safe and what would be legal.
What do you think about the demonstrations?
Well, I really think they're wrong. Even though I'm a freshman, I think they're wrong. I think they ought to be addressed, even though I'll probably be drafted when I get out. I think they really ought to be.
The demonstrators are confronted by the assistant principal of the school, who orders them to leave, which they do according to their previously arranged plan. They head back for the bridge to hold a meeting with themselves, leaving the curiosity watchers behind. They form a circle. Various people speak what's on their mind. And they sing songs of solidarity.
Accomplished today?
To get the students' attention and to face the reality of the draft and that it is nearly upon us and the need to resist. We need to fight now before it's upon us.
Did you expect you'd have more people to join you than you did, or are you pleased with how many you got?
With what we got. We got a lot of negative response, but we also got a lot of positive response also.
What do you think will be the final outcome of this? Do you start people talking about it? Do you think you'll convince some people or what?
Yeah, I think we'll start people talking about it, and we have already convinced a few people about it. And, you know, as long as students are aware of this instead of just oblivious to it, then that's, you know, we did a little more.
They're just so young, you know. And they don't remember Vietnam, and they don't realize they're going to go over there and get killed, you know? I mean, they think about it, but they just don't realize it.
This isn't the end, you know, it's only the beginning.
Okay. We've got to get to class. We can't give them any reason for saying that we can't do
okay,
it.
Thank okay, thank you.
Sure.
And so it's off to class for the usual school day. And yet, hopefully, not the usual school day. The students are hoping that there will be discussions at school, that this demonstration started people thinking and talking. And sure enough, this is exactly what happened, according to some students I talked with. In the classrooms, in the hallways, students, teachers alike were talking about the subject, and particularly in the Maroon, the school newspaper, a lot of space was devoted.
Better get out of them flowers, Lenny, because I got this mean old dog.
So we did get the school's attention, which was one of our main goals, but I think the response is more or less passive because, like, when we got back into class and everything, people just thought we were being radical instead of really having a cause. You know, they didn't understand why we did it. They just thought that it was... We were more or less just trying to be radical instead of protesting for a cause. So I overheard a few conversations. Mostly they were
towards war, but they were a little, they weren't really serious, you know, they were just guesses and, you know, well, if I have to go to war, I'm not going to get out on the battlefield, things like that. Nothing trying to stop going from going to war or trying to resist the draft at all. They're... are aware of this instead of just oblivious to it, then that's, you know, we did a little more, and we're still, this isn't the end, you know, we're gonna, it's only the beginning.
Because the national media ignore or distort a great deal of labor news, we do emphasize this a great deal, so we present information on strikes, on worker safety, and some of the militants going on in the labor movement, and the police and court decisions which affect the labor process and the labor movement.
There's a rich heritage of resistance on the part of workers. Today, in some modest way here on Alternative Views, we're going to try to reclaim some of that legacy of resistance.
On July 16, 1877, some strikers were to be found at Martinsburg, West Virginia. They were very upset about the fact that they had just suffered through a 3.5-year depression, and the company, the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad, had decided to cut their wages for the third time in 3 months. And the city of Martinsburg, as did the cities of Baltimore, and we have a slide later of Pittsburgh, and the city of Buffalo and Harrisburg, a whole series of major railroad centers went up in insurrection and all later in flames.
How extensive was the damage?
The entire railroad yards in Pittsburgh were completely destroyed. It was equivalent to a general strike, and virtually the entire city went out. And interestingly enough, the local militias, the local National Guard, the local police, all dropped their arms and joined in with the strikers.
Similar to what happened in Iran.
In discussing more contemporary struggles, Greg Calvert recalls the nature and significance of the Students for Democratic Society, SDS.
SDS was a refreshing breath in the left, in the Western world. It did have a very open style. It did practice democracy. It had a little of the ideological rigidity that had frozen the minds of the old left. It was, for a number of years, the most creative community of people that I have ever lived amongst, and I must say the most loving.
Mexicans in the United States, besides Native American groups, are the only group to be conquered by the force of arms. We are a conquered people.
The difficulty that women have had in getting mortgages is a long-standing one. Married women were not given the full benefit of their income when they applied with their husbands for a loan. Frequently, their income was discounted completely, or more commonly, by 50%. Sometimes it was discounted entirely if they were in childbearing years, and creditors would say the likelihood is that you're going to quit your work have babies and drop out of the labor pool indefinitely, so therefore we won't consider your income at all. Creditors dealt with this in various ways. Some continued to discount income. Some required what were known in the trade as baby letters. That is, if you'll bring us a letter from your doctor swearing that you're using birth control, or that you've had that you've been sterilized, or promising to have an abortion if you should become pregnant, then we'll count your income.
The mass media almost never critique themselves, so as a result, we very frequently emphasize the mass media, what they're doing, what they're not doing. We also discuss the undiscussable. We talk about things like Marx, nasty words like power structure. The banks, which have the main stock holdings in all these big corporations and have the great amount of interlocking directors with the other corporations, they are also interlocked with each other and own each other.
Right. And
amazing.
I was going to go through more of this, but I'd like to get down to the oil industry, because I think here, particularly since oil is such a hot topic, it is interesting to see the nature of collusion that we have in the oil industry. Exxon is indirectly interlocked. In other words, Exxon meets on the board of directors of a third corporation with other energy concerns. Exxon is the nation's biggest energy company, is directly interlocked with five of the six biggest corporations in the United States. Exxon is also indirectly interlocked with its leading competitors. Mobil, six times. Standard of California, six times. Atlantic Richfield, four times. Texaco, twice. And Standard of Indiana, twice. And Shell, once. Mobil, the second biggest energy company, was similarly connected with its competitors, Exxon, six times, Texaco, four times, Atlantic Richfield, three times, Shell, three times, Standard of California, three times, and Standard of Indiana, three times. As Medcap pointed out, what we have here is an extreme potential through the corporate interlocking mechanisms to provide for stable prices and control of supply and restraint of competition.
The Bilderbergers is a strange thing, because they've been meeting since 1954 and very little has been said about it. There's been almost a complete news blackout. The participants are a mix of the most powerful men in the transnational oil sector of the world economy, the multinational banks, and also the important leaders of the world, political leaders. And this is supplemented by key congressmen, military leaders, representatives from the intelligence and police organizations like CIA and Interpol, the elite foundations, members of the mass media, and the Rockefeller think tanks, and the elite universities. These are people from the NATO countries, basically, and they're people like this from the U.S. who meet with their counterparts in three-day meetings in extreme secrecy.
If the Bilderbergs have been secretive, it's at least time for them to sort of present some of their programs. Eventually they have to do this, they know. So I think this presentation has taken the form of a new organization in which there is a great deal of overlap, the Trilateral Commission. Again, we find David Rockefeller at the very pinnacle of the Trilateral Commission. What they would like to do is fashion a stable world order on the after the fashion of the one produced after World War II by many of the same people and certainly the same interests as represented, for instance, in the Council on Foreign Relations. Carter, Mondale, and in the Republican camp, Elliot Richardson were all invited to be commissioners with the hope that at least one of these people would be the future president. As it turns out, of course, Carter has become president, and out of the 74 American commissioners, about 21 of them are now in the Carter administration at very high levels.
Tonight's program, the centerpiece of tonight's program, is a discussion of Karl Marx and socialism today, not a topic I'm sure you're used to hearing on American television. And joining us on the panel tonight is someone with an experience of socialism in its practice, Sveta Stahanovic of Yugoslavia, a visiting professor here in the government department at the University of Texas.
For me, socialism is linked essentially with democracy. There cannot be socialism without democracy. Even the word suggests this. Even the property cannot be a social property without democracy. It can be a statist property. The state controls it, but not the people, not the society. So, for me, socialism then is fully developed democracy, and that means democracy in all spheres of social life, including economy. These are structural limitations of capitalism I'm talking about now. Now, democracy in all spheres of social life, or universal democracy. Second, democracy should be as substantial and as less formal as possible. Substantial.
Real democracy.
Real democracy, meaning not simply equal rights, mm-hmm. but equal possibilities for the people to use them.
We provide a lot of controversy, too. And along with it, a pretty heavy dose of reality.
I'm talking about the 96% of the food price increases that we've had in the last 20 years have gone not to farmers at all, but to corporate middlemen, the people that take the food from the farm and sell it to consumers. That's primarily the processors, the grain shippers, the cotton trade, and the supermarkets in the country are who you're dealing with there.
Reality in the farm and food situation was presented by author and editor of Texas Observer, Jim Hightower, and by Professor Fran Hill.
With sufficient care, we have got now in America an agricultural policy process, by choice, which is so fragmented we can't deal simultaneously with the two ends of a chicken. Therefore, we know it's impossible to deal with the big issues which are going to determine the future structure of American agriculture.
The same thing that's happening in our general economy, that's happening in automobiles and tires and various other commodities, is now beginning to happen in food. We've got a situation where now just, they said, as you pointed out earlier, in 1968, they said the merger movement was over. We should not worry about the economic structure of the food economy because all those mergers were over. Well, not only is it not over, it has become a great deal worse. In 1965, the top 50 firms, top 50 food processors, produced 50% of the profits. They had half of the profits in the food industry, which was already a very high level of concentration, higher than most of our people realize. By 1975, when I wrote this book, that level of profit concentration had risen to 75%. The top 50 companies then controlled 75%. Today, the top 50 companies control 90% of the profits in the food industry. So that concentration really is proceeding dramatically. I took a look at it. You might wonder who some of these companies are, and that's not always easy to find out, because food now is a product of consumer product conglomerates, they call themselves, and very few of them have food even as their primary resource. The two largest are not even American corporations, which will drive you xenophobes crazy.
Alternative Views has occasionally turned its attention to the terrifying reality of the Kennedy assassination.
This is the famous Abraham Zapruder film of the Kennedy assassination. As the president's limousine emerges from behind the sign, it's obvious he has been struck by a bullet. He slumps forward, and then the fatal headshot. Now here is blow-ups of just the president in the Zapruder film. Again, as he passes the sign, he's obviously been hit, and then the fatal headshot. The president's reaction to the headshot can be seen more clearly with these enlargements. Notice that as the president is struck by the fatal headshot, his body is driven violently backwards. This again is the footage of the president on Houston Street before the fatal ride down Elm Street. This is the next film of the assassination, taken by another eyewitness to the assassination who is on the south side of Elm Street. His film captures all the witnesses running towards the grassy knoll area. That's an area to the right front of the presidential car. The majority of witnesses thought the shots came from the right front.
This first one was taken at almost the instant of the first shot. Here you can see the president right over this patrolman's shoulder. And if you look right up here on the little concrete wall, you can see Abraham Zapruder and his secretary.
Oh.
Zapruder filmed his famous motion picture. So it's a good, clear view. And there you can get a good idea of the perspective of a man that distance from the president. This photograph is very important because of right down at the end of this little low white wall, there is a man standing. Now, even the new committee had to admit that this was a man standing behind the wall and that there is a long object sticking upward out of his hand, and a good possibility that it was a rifle.
Now, that's just before the shot.
Just at the time of the first shots.
I'd like to add this for the benefit of those out there watching this on their TVs. I personally didn't know whether to believe this particular part of it or not until you see the photos close up. The photos close up definitely show a man standing at the end of the wall.
Well, even with their image enhancement and their sophisticated techniques, they have had to admit. And on a photograph immediately following that, taken by the same photographer, you can see very quickly that at the end of the wall, there's no longer a man there.
And this was taken right after
a few seconds? Was within 6 seconds.
Six seconds.
Now, even that wouldn't be conclusive, except more than 50 of the Dealey Plaza eyewitnesses said that shots were fired from this position that day.
Your revelations about the CIA and other authors' criticism and exposing the CIA, is this really more harmful to the United States and more helpful to the Soviet Union and the KGB?
Well, what really harms the United States is when we get ourselves in trouble, when we undertake activities which are so much against our long-term national interests, which amount to being crimes against humanity, and the world sees what we do. It's in the nature of our system that we have, perhaps less so all the time as the government tries to restrict our freedom of speech, but we have freedom of speech. It's a government of the people and by the people and for the people. And the only way that can work is through public exercise of your power and mine to criticize and pressure and expose situations that you and you and I think are wrong. This was the basic argument that was thrown against the anti-war activists of the 60s and 70s that got us out of Vietnam. The government, particularly Nixon's administration, was attacking these people, running the FBI against them, doing everything it could to discredit them and saying, you, Jane Fonda, or Cora Weiss, or a university student here or there, you're anti-American, you're sabotaging our great war effort. And of course, this is the end, the administration trying to perpetuate their own control and consolidate their own control of power by discrediting anyone that attacks them by saying they're un-American. I'm definitely exposing activities and criticizing activities of the CIA with the objective of giving the American people the information that they need, apart from the myth that have strengthened and perpetuated this organization, as it's done truly un-American things in the sense of things that castrated our country overseas and discredited it extensively. The only way we can function to straighten out this or any other corrupt situation in our government is for people to speak out. And by the exercise of this power, I'm convinced that we wind up with a stronger nation and not a weaker one.
Author and professor Peter Bell tells of the not-so-jolly side of old England.
It's substantially changed. Yes, England is not like, I think, many people in this country think it is. I think they have an extraordinarily romantic conception of it. I think they regard its accent as typical of its civility, its politeness. In fact, as the last 10 years in particular have shown, and some of the things we want to talk about here have shown, it's a society with considerable degrees of brutality, of social unrest, of social conflict, and of growing levels of repression inside, of social turmoil, of class struggle, of political instability, and so on. What it almost amounts to, from an American perspective, would be almost a breakdown of a social system. If things did not work over here the way they do not work over there, it would be a national emergency.
Perhaps the most burning issue today is the environment and what we're doing to it. Alternative Views has devoted much time to this problem.
By 1986 in Texas, you've got some pretty severe pollution that's going to be coming down, in great quantities of it too. Hundreds of thousands of tons, millions of tons of sulfur dioxides and nitrogen oxides. And there's a simple statement, what goes up must come down. This stuff is going to come down. It's going to come down on our crops. It's going to come down on our buildings. It's going to come down on us. Sulfur dioxide's probably one of the most dangerous of air pollutants that's released into the atmosphere. The Texas Energy Outlook estimates that if all proposed coal and lignite mines go into operation by 1985, Texas will see a 55% increase in sulfur oxides in our atmosphere. A lignite plant will burn up, 114 kilograms of thorium-232, 18.5 kilograms of uranium-238, and 134.4 grams of uranium-235, which is what they make plutonium from.
If you take a pound of plutonium and you could put a little tiny piece in every person's lung on Earth, 1 pound would be enough to kill every person on Earth with lung cancer. You can't do that, but if you could. Plutonium has a half-life of 24,400 years, so it's biologically dangerous for 500,000 years. If I die of a lung cancer induced by plutonium and I'm cremated, the smoke goes out the chimney to be breathed conceivably into somebody else's lung ad infinitum. The body thinks plutonium is iron. It combines with the iron transporting protein in the blood. It's deposited in the iron storage cells in the liver, where it causes liver cancer. On the endosteal, or the surface of the bone, where it causes bone cancer and leukemia. It crosses the placenta into the developing embryo, where, like thalidomide, the drug pregnant women took years ago to alleviate morning sickness, it can cause gross deformities, but it can do it forever. We had a bumper sticker in Australia which said, plutonium is thalidomide forever. On to fetus after fetus. And it concentrates in the testicles and the ovaries. And everyone in the Northern Hemisphere has a very small load of plutonium already in their testicles and ovaries from fallout. And as it is so mutagenic, we don't know what that means for future generations. The arrogance to say, even to our children when we're dead, sorry buddies, we needed this to turn on our lights and work our electric toothbrushes and our hair dryers, you look after it now. I mean, that's just our children, but what about our 100 generations from now? Who are we to do this to them? You know, the National Council of Churches predict epidemics of leukemia and cancer in young people as a result of just the plutonium, let alone the other elements. The geneticists say we don't have to worry about watching for genetic implications over generations. Well, I'll be dead of cancer and leukemia before then. That's what the geneticists say, some of them, because plutonium is so toxic. How can we do this to our descendants? You know, if we believe in a God, we surely have a responsibility before God to future generations. Who are these arrogant people who are doing this?
The Mayas and the Aztecs, human sacrifices were not unknown. And in the dawning of the Hebraic God, even Abraham, the Bible tells us, was prepared to sacrifice his own son to prove his fidelity to God. But more terrible than anything was the God of the Phoenicians and the Ammonites, the God Moloch, who demanded the most terrible sacrifice of all. Moloch demanded the sacrifice of children who died by fire. We stand here today before a modern-day Moloch.
If you're driving through the country on a lazy afternoon, or you're watching your children playing after school, to do
always end alternative views with a bedtime story, something designed to leave the viewers with a grimace, a snarl, or a tear.
There's a picture of the Bethlehem Steelworks. Slaughter at the Point is the name of the story. And when we talk about safety, we should think about individuals. Robert Carter, Robert Hall, Dunlop Johnson. Never heard of them before. But their stories tell the very grisly truth of the working conditions of the steel industry. Robert Carter was working in a blast furnace, which was one of three that was built back in the 1880s, although they'd been supposedly updated 19 years ago. Bethlehem had paid weekly fines to operate these three furnaces, which did not meet the pollution standards. They leaked poison gases constantly. Well, 3 weeks after starting work, Carter was killed, overcome by carbon monoxide gas. July 78, the hottest day of the summer, Dunlop Johnson died from heat stroke. He was working in the open heart furnaces where steel is made. Steel melts at 2,600 degrees, and it was 101 outside. Another worker has severe brain damage and still is in a coma. In June 78, Robert Hall died while working in a wire rope mill. He ran a high-speed wire drawing machine, and the machine didn't have any safety guards. The speeding wire caught Hall's hand and dragged him head first into the giant wire spool. 1970, the Occupational Safety Hazard Administration, OSHA, had cited Bethlehem Steel for neglecting safety such as this. They fined them $27,200, and when Dunlop Johnson died, they upped it another $7,000. So this is something to remember when people talk about getting the government out of business and OSHA coming in and telling business what to do. We might remember Robert Carter, Robert Hall, and Dunlop Johnson. Good night.
Alternative Views is a production of the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. Alternative Views.